Welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. On this week's agenda, I am still not back in the UK. Do number ones matter? Put the needle on the record and Night of the Living Ed. Fraser, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I am on the final day of the MoPop conference in Seattle, which is a conference dedicated to music writing and, well, not necessarily just music writing, there's academics here as well. And it's hundreds of people presenting papers on their specialist subject, and it's like pure, it's like nerd heaven. It's like summer camp for music dorks.
So what kind of subjects will you have covered?
This week, I haven't seen as many papers as I would have liked to because I was a bit late in writing mine, so I had to spend some time in my hotel room. But I've seen people talk about Justin Bieber and Christianity and Morrissey and the way that he uses the signifiers of disability in his work. I saw a brilliant one by the journalist Anne Powers about Jim Morrison's penis.
Was it quite short?
That definitely came up. I was on a great one yesterday with my friend Hazel Sheffield, so she was talking about Sleaford mods and the death of the 60s dream. My friend Anna Vleskovich was talking about how different pop stars have used the barbican in pop videos and whether or not their interaction with it reflects the complexes, like utopian slash conflicted ideals. And we were also on a panel with the brilliant Tom Ewing, who was also a charts obsessive, and he talked about how, in a very kind of comic pithy fashion, about how Eurovision definitely caused Brexit, which was just so funny. And then last night there was a kind of a big keynote talk with Mike Hadrius from Perfume Genius, the Canadian indigenous singer Tanya Tagak, who did a performance that was just out of this world. Imagine somebody like singing the sounds of an Aphex Twin record from their mouth, but in a not at all gimmicky way. Just the sounds she was making were unbelievable. And then Meredith Graves, who's an MTV News presenter. So yeah, it's been heaven. People might be able to hear that I sound a bit croaky. This is because I was doing karaoke until 1:45. With my friend Hazel, we did Mel C and Bryan Adams' When You're Gone, which is a brilliant song to karaoke to, but none of the Americans knew it. So it went down slightly like a lead balloon, or there was a bit of bemusement in the room. But then we got our stars back by doing Waterloo by ABBA, which is a completely joyful song to do at karaoke. But yeah, my voice has gone a bit now.
So in full interview mode, if there was something that you would say has changed your view of how the British charts are operating at the moment, or how pop music operates in 2017, or something that just makes you think, I'd never applied that filter to the charts that you've learned over the last couple of days. Is there something like that?
I mean, there have actually been some really interesting presentations that are kind of specifically about charts. I don't know that I've kind of like come away with any new filters to think about them, but one of my other favourite papers that I've seen that I forgot to mention was by a guy called Chris Malanfi, who is like the American charts expert. And he did a fantastic one about the decline of the All-Star charity single, where he looked at, he started with Band-Aid and We Are the World, which, I mean, I barely know that one. And he was kind of pitting them head-to-head via their various stats and the way that they're constructed. But then he kind of tailed off into looking at the other many American and Canadian charity singles, things like Farm Aid and songs for the AIDS crisis and all of these like well-intentioned, but songs that have not lasted the test of time. So that was a real education.
I know we need to get on and do our podcast and everything else. Have you genuinely no idea about We Are the World?
I mean, I vaguely know the song, but I couldn't really have told you what it was about. I don't know when it came out. I think it's like quite before my time.
It's 85, I think. It's the year after Band-Aid. So it is the year of Live Aid. And it's a really odd song. I mean, it came out at the peak of Michael Jackson's popularity, and he co-wrote it. And bits of it are brilliant, and some bits of it are really bad. There is also, and this is a tangent upon a tangent upon a left-hand turn, there's a video on YouTube. I'll try and find it and put it in the podcast notes, from a Asian TV show where there are people who are impersonators of every single pop star in We Are the World, and they're singing live, but they're singing pidgin English lyrics because they don't, either English is a language they don't speak or it's not their first language. So it's like phonetic version of all of the lyrics in We Are the World, but there is a let's say they're Korean. I don't know if they are, but there's a Korean Bruce Springsteen singing next to a Korean Cyndi Lauper, and there's a Korean Willie Nelson, and a Korean Stevie Wonder, and a Korean Ray Charles, and it's, I think even, it might even be that the black artists are Koreans blacked up. It's the most insane video, because there's a point at which the Korean Bruce Springsteen comes in with his bit, which always in the original song sounds about a million times louder than everybody else's bit anyway. It's paint stripping. It's incredibly...
I mean, that song's not subtle to begin with. We spent some time in the presentation dwelling on the Cyndi Lauper line, which barely sounds like singing. It sounds more like an anguish cry of pain.
Well, if you imagine that, because the Cyndi Lauper is equally wince-inducing, if you imagine that making even less sense, like, because at least in the American version, she's singing, whoa, 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 let's realise that a change can only come. If you imagine that, but with none of those words actually making sense in a language that you're familiar with, but still at that pitch and that shrillness, that's this video. So, I mean, in a way, We Are the World has always been exceptionally ruined by that, but made all the more glorious for it.
Well, if we can refine that, that's definitely one for the show notes.
I'll dig it up.
So this week, because it has been Record Store Day and because the actual top 10 is pretty stagnant with a few exceptions, we thought we'd take a look at the vinyl top 10, which there's a lot going on. It's all new to us, as in things that we haven't yet discussed on the charts. It's also a very bizarre array of songs.
Yeah, it's like a mixture of re-releases of things, and some things are 2 or 3 years out of date. Some of them, I mean, we can only presume that the sales figures that are used to compile the best-selling singles on vinyl on a week-by-week basis are in the low 20s.
Yeah, definitely not more than a couple of hundred.
No, and so things, you know, reliable sellers or things with peaks will probably appear. But it's like Narnia. It's like seeing a whole different reality of a whole different culture suddenly appear. But I mean, we're obviously doing this because if anybody remembers the ITV chart show upon which our logo is based, there were different charts on a week by week basis. So this is our version of doing the indie chart week, when you could see videos from We've Got a Fuzzbox and We're Going to Use It and Ted Chippington on ITV on a Saturday morning.
I don't know that, because one of the great things about the old ITV indie chart is it was a good way of gaming, getting the songs that you wanted in the charts. The few independent shops that did the sales and return things and told the charts company how much they had sold, they would lie about their favourite songs to try and get them in the charts, and therefore get them on the ITV chart show, and then by virtue of their video, probably hastily cobbled together because they may not have had one a week before, it would then get in the actual chart. I think, is it like New Fast Automatic Daffodils are one of the big beneficiaries of that tiny scam?
Yeah, I think so. And, but I mean, so many of the indie band pop videos were just made with them taking a Super 8 camera with them when they went on tour, and just larking about in a Hard Day's Night style, and then editing it back together. Can't Take No More by the Soup Dragons certainly was.
So, at number 10 is Slaves with Cheer Up London.
Yeah, Cheer Up London, you're already dead, they shout. And the thing with this is it's already really out of date, this record. It's not, like, it's an attack on the complacency of modern culture, and you're like, we're not complacent. At least 52% of us are scared out of our wits at the moment because of, oh, everything that's going on. And massive changes on the horizon. We're all looking to the news more than we are looking to music to provide us with stability, and it isn't coming from there, and everybody is a little bit nervous. So whilst it's exhilarating to be shouted at in a, you know, in a kind of rock cockney way, it just seems like this song feels really dated already.
Yeah, actually, I didn't talk about the paper that I did at the conference, but I talked about, my piece was called Where Have All the Protest Songs Gone? And it was a paper about articles that like to ask, where has all the protest music gone? Kind of pulling apart all their tropes and trying to figure out what they're actually looking for. And more often than not, what they're actually looking for is young white lads like Slaves who get a free pass to, you know, as soon as they say something like, cheer up, London, you're already dead. Everyone's like, oh, political saviours. Oh, yeah, so glad they're around to save us all. But then any kind of artist who diverges from that kind of straight white male template, they have to prove themselves a lot harder if they're going to be taken seriously as political artists. Yeah, I really don't have very much good to say about Slaves.
Well, let's move on. At number 9 is Real Love Baby by Father John Misty. And at number 8 is No Plan by David Bowie.
Seamlessly skimmed over another man I have nothing good to say about. Yes, this David Bowie posthumous EP, it would have been released on... it was released on what would have been his 70th birthday. And it has some songs from the musical Lazarus. I mean, this is a gorgeous piece of work. I don't like the idea of dead artists' back catalogues just being raided for every single thing they ever did, and, you know, potentially incomplete things being put out that they might have been horrified to know the public were hearing. I am glad that we got to extend Black Star a little bit, because it's such a, like, spellbinding record.
And it's that thing of, it felt like Black Star was being released and then brutally chopped off, and there was that 7-day period in between it coming out and David Bowie dying.
Where no, like 3 days, because it was a Friday release.
Oh, you're right. Actually, it was really short, wasn't it? You know, your initial reactions were, oh, great, a new David Bowie album. I wonder what it's all about. And then by the third day, it's like, oh, well, maybe we should have a look at it now that we know that he's dead, because that seems to be, you know, maybe there's a filter. Maybe you could look at it from that filter. So the initial first listen responses had nothing of the mortality in Black Star. And then suddenly people were seeing, oh, actually, maybe there's some more to it. Mm. Maybe he was saying stuff. So now it feels, because the very last thing he did while he was still alive wrong-footed so many people, it's like, well, we just need to be absolutely sure that he hasn't left us any more messages somewhere. Let's you know, especially when the record label for Black Star turned out to have hidden surprises in it. I'm sure people are out there with metal detectors now checking for Bowie songs in their garden. It just feel like he still had stuff still to say.
Yeah, I mean, I might be reading too much into this, but I wrote about the song No Plan when it first came out, and I might be kind of like, you know, pulling at straws a little bit, but it really reminded me of David Bowie's own version of My Way or something like that. And also, curiously, that's the song that he contributed to in the first place, because I think he wrote a version of it that then didn't really do anything, but then actually got turned into the My Way that we know. And it seems very much his kind of like, I mean, it's part My Way and also part like Je ne regrette rien. Yeah, I think it's a gorgeous song, and I do wonder if he purposely left it off Black Star, because it seemingly makes so explicit everything he was going through at that time.
You just can't tell. That's the nature of inscrutability, and that's, you know, that's what made him such a great artist. So let's move on. Number 7, Was It Really Worth It by the Sherlocks. Let's have a listen to this now. Oh, I've seen that you're looking at me. You haven't smoked all night, but you're looking at me. Oh, you think you're right, but don't think twice, it's someone else. Oh, how's it feel to be perfect? And was it really worth it all along? So that's your sound of actual landfill indie still being made in 2017. It's like a heritage industry now. Hey, is anyone still out there chipping away at the landfill indie rock face? Yes, the Sherlocks are. And they're still doing that thing where they have a guitar playing a really basic sounding melody with another guitar chugging away underneath, and it's all a bit, whoa, oh, off we go, and it's like the beginning of the Inbetweeners. And it sounds like, do you remember, Laura, when the Arctic Monkeys first came out and there were a plethora of bands from Sheffield that all got record labels because of the Arctic Monkeys?
Oh, yeah. I think Milburn even played at Bunters in Truro.
Well, the one band that I was really stuck in my head was Little Man Tate, because they were mates with the Arctic Monkeys or something, and they had one song that I quite liked called The Agent, but everything else after that was just a bit too knowing. And once Alex Turner had opened the Tupperware box on social observation in indie rock songs, all the people that weren't quite as skilled as he was as a lyricist were coming out going, I've seen some things, men, they get drunk. And that was Little Man Tate, and this just sounds to me exactly like Little Man Tate.
Yeah, I mean, I had never heard this song before, but although it is like, you know, classic landfill indie, I don't think it's as, maybe it's not that unusual. I think it's the kind of song that's probably had like massive support from the Steve Lamacq Show, which, you know, obviously trades in this kind of thing, and I think is still the biggest show on BBC Six Music. As much as it's kind of, you know, written off as a dead cultural property, I imagine that this kind of music is still kind of, you know, a big rite of passage for a lot of teenagers. I kind of almost find it heartening in a way, much as I'm not really bothered by this song either way. I kind of find it heartening by the fact that there are songs like this in the vinyl top 10, because it's exactly the kind of song that I would once have gone to HMV on a Monday morning before school to go and buy. Like, you know, I had all 7 inches by bands like Good Shoes, and I probably had them by Little Man Tate. I think I had a bright yellow one by The Holloways, and I don't know, there's something maybe it's just, you know, affirming my own nostalgia, but I think there's something quite sweet about the fact that clearly somewhere, some presumably young people or maybe very old people are going, I must own this on 7-inch.
Yeah, because I will come back to that in a bit when we start to talk about another record further up the list. But we will move on just now for something that's much more vivid. This is number 6 is Long Time by Blondie. Does it take you a long time? Does it make you upset? Does it make you think everybody wants to be your friend? I can give you a heartbeat. I can give you a friend. I can make you think everybody wants to be your friend.
So that's from Blondie's new album, which I think is called Pollinator. It's written by Dev Hynes. I would say it's like, I do like Dev Hynes productions, but I think people thinking that Dev Hynes is going to be the kind of savior of pop music is fairly misguided. As time has shown, he's not really had a lot of big pop hits, much as people want him to do that. But I really like it. But also, you know, I think this may be very much besides the point of what it was meant to be. It very much reminds me of One Direction's Live While We're Young, that crazy, crazy, crazy bit in the chorus.
I think the thing with this is it sounds like Blondie. It sounds like Sunday Girl and Union City Blue and Heart of Glass most distinctively, but also a little bit like Where the Streets Have No Name by U2. And I just think, would the all classic rock comebacks, we had that thing a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Texas and the Kooks and all of that, would that they had released singles that were this assured, this bolshy and this vivid? Because it just sounds like alive people doing alive stuff. Debbie Harry is 70.
I know. I do think it, you know, because they've been a fairly consistent property. They've not really gone away over the past 2 decades. But it's always been kind of a case of diminishing returns and trying to live up to former glories. But I think this is definitely their best comeback song since Maria, which I can now appreciate, though it's a song that I hated as a child because I think it also spent what seemed to me then an inordinate amount of time at number one. You know, keeping what I believe to be good music off number one. But now I can appreciate Maria and Long Time alongside it.
Track 5 in our top 10 of the vinyl singles of the week is Live 2 by Bon Jovi, which is a live Bon Jovi picture disc. It's a pat on the head for record collectors, but nothing exciting here for people who like music. So we'll move on to number 4, which again is a reissue. It's Sound and Vision by David Bowie. It's a great song, perhaps a slightly pointless reissue. You can certainly still find old copies of Sound and Vision as a single in record shops. The only thing I wanted to say about this is my personal relationship with the song. I once, when my son was 6 months old, I once did a classic dad thing where I had two pencils and an iPhone, and I was bored, and I put the song on my computer, set up the iPhone so it was filming us, and I held my hands over his hands and held the pencils as if they were drumsticks, and then we did air drumming to the beginning of Sound and Vision while he, a 6 month old, just looked supremely bored. I had a black top on, he had a black top, so it just looks a little bit like he's like the hands are actually far closer to the camera than you might think, and it sort of works, and it's one of my favorite videos of him when he was tiny.
At number 3 is bizarrely Haim with My Song 5, a song that was originally released in 2014 and something like the 6th single to come off their debut album. I mean, I like this song, but I can't understand why it's still in the charts. Like, it might make sense that, like we were saying, like not very many singles are being told in order to get into this charts, but for it to be number 3, it must still be being pressed in some quantity.
Or, well, I mean, does that, it may not be, it may just be that a shop somewhere has had a sale and they've offloaded all of the, because this is how few copies are being sold, so there's a shop in, you know, Wolverhampton or somewhere that's gone, oh, we've got loads of copies of this Haim single, so we just put them on for 10p each, and a load of indie kids have bought them.
An exciting prelude to new Haim music, which I think is meant to be coming out next week.
So at number 2 we have Be Lucky by The Who. Be Lucky, and let's have a quick listen to that now. Be Lucky. Anybody listening to that will be aware that that just sounds like an outtake from the recorded soundtrack to the film Quadrophenia from 1979. It's not in any way peak Who, it's not prime Who. It does what the Who did when they were sort of revving in neutral, really. It doesn't. It's a really odd record for that, because in Pete Townshend, there we have one of rock slash pop music's most distinctive songwriters, capable of doing all sorts of wonderful things, and I haven't heard a song from him in so long that did anything other than say, yeah, I'm still in the Who, yeah, we're still doing this noise, this is just what we do now.
Well, like you say, there's lots of like reissues, like fairly pointless reissues during this. I wonder what people do with them when they bought them, because although, you know, not to kind of, you know, get on banging on about vinyl collectors, but when something like Sound and Vision is reissued for, you know, probably the 10th time or something like that, I can appreciate, you know, I am a completist about some things, but surely there's a part of you that knows in the back of your mind there is nothing special about this. It has just been pumped out to try and drive sales around a particular event or anniversary or something like that. If you're not getting anything new and you're just getting a repackage, what's the point where you jump off?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that song, Be Lucky, was only released as a single because it was part of a greatest hits album, which I sort of understand. And sometimes those things do sort of provoke bands to address the entire history of their sound and create something that is, you know, good. But this is not one of those times. And it's always been a problem with reissue culture in general, in that, you know, the object is given precedence over what music it contains. And that's the point at which it leaves me behind completely. I really genuinely don't care about the object. I don't care about pitch discs or special vinyl or anything like that. I want to hear the songs, I want to hear the ideas, and I want to think about what they do to me emotionally. And that's all I want from music. And it's all music's ever done for me. And I'm happy with that. It's mm-hmm. wonderful.
Well, on that note, I'm really heartened that like the number one in this vinyl singles chart is by a young band, I think they're from Brighton, called Black Honey, and the song is called Hello Today.
So that's Hello Today by Black Honey. It's kind of, I like that. It's good, isn't it? Funky indie rock. It sounds quite a lot more 1992 than 2006 and is kind of all the better for that. This is the sort of thing that I would have bought in my youth, in that kind of get me to the record shop, I've got to have that, because they, you know, it sounds like people my own age, although they aren't anymore, but at the time, people my own age doing things that I would like to do myself. And it's got shades of Wolf Alice to it, and I think that Wolf Alice, of all of the current crop of indie guitar bands that are venerated by the enemy, are my absolute favourites, mm-hmm. you know, because they just have a spirit to them. They've got an element of, you know, indie rock throughout the 1980s and 1990s, which is sort of my era anyway, that really appeals to me. So again, it does push the right buttons for me. It's like, oh well, this reminds me of the Breeders or whoever, but I like it for that.
So let's move on to some correspondence we've had. Thank you very much to everybody who has emailed in. You can email us on unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com, and we have more emails that we can get through this week, but we will come back to them next week. This is an email from Sophia, which really strikes kind of at the very heart of Unbreak My Chart and why we do this thing. She says, I have a question for the podcast. When we live in times where Drake and Ed Sheeran can be number one for over 10 weeks, how much do we think chart positions matter in terms of longevity or the formation of the icon? I wonder because Beyoncé, for example, hasn't had a top 10 single in years, and someone who is considered a huge name in pop like Katy Perry made a comeback with Chained to the Rhythm that went to number 5 and number 4 in the US and UK respectively. Meanwhile, someone like James Arthur, who is somehow still lingering in the top 20 both here and in the US, isn't even towing the line of superstardom. It's a question I've been considering, especially after midweek predictions for Harry Styles are suggesting he will slip to number 4 in the UK, which he did, and 18 in the US, which doesn't surprise me given Kendrick Lamar's streaming figures. And I think, given SNL and Rolling Stone and so on, the chart is less of an indicator of cultural significance than it used to be. Despite tabloid headlines that seem determined to suggest otherwise, do we think charting high is necessary anymore? And what other factors come into play? Social media following, touring, simply being ubiquitous for reasons good or bad?
I did a piece for BBC Music a while ago, which had a kind of frivolous title, which was Who is the Current King or Queen of Pop? And I just ran some stats So I wanted to figure out how you would claim nowadays, bearing in mind that Michael Jackson's no longer with us. So first of all, it was Michael Jackson's no longer with us. Clearly, there's a vacancy for the position. And then it was actually, is Madonna still the queen of pop? And is the current king of pop, or the pop ruling monarch, a man or a woman at the moment? So this, and the statistics that I ran were chart position. It was actually, it was weeks in the singles chart. So that's what we were looking at. So it's longevity. So there wouldn't be that thing of, you know, five number ones. It would be how long your song has lingered. Mm-hmm. So Drake would have scored quite highly for One Dance. Social media followers. I think we did something like gig revenue or ticket sales or something to do with live performances, because that seems to be an important part of it as well. You couldn't find an accurate way of representing pop culture presence within media, but certainly if you looked at it in terms of Twitter and Facebook, or Twitter and Instagram, I think we went with. And it's an entirely specious series. I mean, it's no different to creating your own chart, you know, the way that the current singles chart is made. But what we found out was that the certainly of the top five, four of them are female, and it is Beyonce and Rihanna. Rihanna really scored highly because she just kept releasing singles that were hits. And so constantly over and over and over again, you know, whilst only a few of them were actually number one, loads of them were really highly charting and lingered for a long time. And there were just so many of them. But actually the number one in the end was Justin Bieber. And he, you know, so you end up with the conclusion that Justin Bieber is the current king of pop. So I think there are other, definitely we're in a world now where there are so many other factors that come into play as to whether someone is iconically a pop star in the, you know, the everybody knows their name sense. Nobody outside of people who know about music know who James Arthur is, apart from his X Factor connection. Whereas everybody knows who Beyonce is, you know. So in a way, Sophia is absolutely right, I think. What do you think, Laura?
I think it's more about media saturation. So it's less to do with the music directly and more about media saturation that makes somebody the biggest thing in the world. I think once a musician gets to the point where their every move is being documented, I think it's that kind of thing that make people really, really massive. But I think if you look at somebody like Taylor Swift, she always has, her albums do really well. She definitely hasn't had that kind of single saturation that artists like Ed Sheeran have had, though I suppose maybe she hasn't released an album kind of in the current streaming climate. I'll be really curious to see whether she takes over the charts in the same way that he did. But she is, you know, probably one of the top three female pop stars, one of the top three pop stars in the world, because every single thing that she does gets coverage, and she's a very canny manager of her image, and she knows exactly how you play kind of the news cycle. So I think it's, you know, yeah, I think Sophia makes a really good point about Beyonce, somebody who really doesn't have a lot of chart success at all, and also doesn't really seem bothered by it, you know, when she releases an album exclusively on Tidal or HBO or whatever it was, that last one. So I'd say the chart is definitely less an indicator of cultural significance than it used to be. I'd be interested to talk to people at labels about whether they actually care about whether something is number one, because I feel like at the moment when something's number one, it's either really fleeting and it's just a blip that doesn't really carry all that much significance, or you have the Ed Sheeran Drake kind of thing where it's number one forever and ever and it's just shoring up their kind of monolithic status. I think we've talked about this before on the podcast, but I think that there's a massive divide between, you know, regular pop stars like people like James Arthur, and then, I mean, up from him, but people like Little Mix and stuff who do well in the charts, but they're not trouncing the charts by any measure. You know, they might get a number one, but them getting a number one for like a couple of weeks is not the same as Ed Sheeran being at number one or Drake being at number one, if that makes sense.
Interestingly, I think the Drake situation was part of the making of him as a pop star. Although he was massive on the internet, and you know, there are obviously people now throwing their hands up going, everybody knew who Drake was in 2013, man, where have you been? I think that the point at which he has a song that troubles the Bryan Adams Wet 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 record, which is, you know, to a greater extent in the public imagination, that's the chart record. Once he got to the point of threatening that, it was like, well, he's clearly big news then, this Drake fellow. I must find out more about him. And that is the break. That is the difference between pop stars, and as in pop stars, capital letters, and people who are doing well in music, is that they are heard about and discussed by people who have absolutely no idea what's going on in the charts week on week, or what's going on with music week on week, and probably wouldn't be able to tell you who Drake is affiliated with, where he's coming from or anything like that, but they will know that there was that song about a man dancing on his own that was whatever it is about, I don't like that song, that was, you know, number one for a really, really long time. What I was also going to say is one of the reasons why this is important to us at Unbreak My Chart is that we are more interested in the fact that the chart is still a reliable metric of what people are actually listening to, irrespective of who they are talking about in terms of celebrity culture and gossip. That doesn't mean that either of us particularly look down on celebrity culture and gossip, and oh my word, if you could hear us having a gossip, you'd know that. But actually, the thing that we're interested in with the chart is, if this is a reliable metric for what people are listening to, what does that say about what's going on? You know, and that's why the Ed Sheeran thing is so interesting a place to start, because, you know, there was a moment at which it would arguably everybody that was into music in the UK was discovering what was on this Ed Sheeran album and picking favourites, and they made Galway Girl happen.
So we're going to take a look at the actual top 10 this week, which, as I said, is pretty stagnant. I think I could probably do it with my eyes shut now. At number 10 is Julia Michaels with Issues, which I must say is growing on me. I mean, probably again through repeat exposure to American pop radio, which plays the same song 3 times an hour. But yeah, well done, Julia Michaels.
It's going up. It's going up a place in the face of everything. Everyone shuffling down a place to make way for one particular song that's arrived further up the chart. So well done, especially because everyone's just like, oh fine, I'll get out your way then. That's number 10. At number 9 is Stay by Zedd featuring Alicia Cara. At number 8 is Martin Jensen's Solo Dance, and number 7, the Chainsmokers and Coldplay, Something Just Like This, which means at number 6 is Kendrick Lamar with Humble full stop. And let's listen to a bit of that. AM to the PM, PM to the AM phone. Out your per diem, you just gotta hate them funk. If I quit your BM, I still rock Mercedes funk. If I quit this season, I still be the greatest funk. My left stroke just went viral. Right stroke, pull a baby in a spot. So that's one of 5 entries in this week's chart from the new album Damn, full stop. The question is, in a situation like this, I mean, where people are getting to know the entire album, what are the qualities that make some songs worth repeating early on? So at number 18, we've got DNA, full stop, and then Element, full stop, is at number 33. And those two are really like fast, frenetic songs, like real tongue twisters. But then at number 27, you've got Loyalty, full stop, which features Rihanna. So you'd think that maybe the successful songs would be about the guest spots. But then XXX, full stop, too many stops, features U2, and that isn't even here at all, even for curiosity's sake. I wonder if it's about the video. The only two songs at the moment that have videos are DNA and Humble, and of the two, Humble is definitely the more stylish video. Yeah. I mean, I think there is something about Humble that sonically sets itself out as being a single, but it's an odd one, isn't it? Because actually the XXX full stop, which is the U2 one, it's not a bad song. It is a bit drifty and strange, but I would have thought that it would be getting hate listens. I would have thought that people would be listening to it going, U2 and Kendrick Lamar, what the actual heck, and rushing to that one more so than, you know, working their way solidly through the album. And it doesn't seem to be the case.
I reckon it's one that people will have excised from their own personal Kendrick playlist. That's the thing about Spotify. You can just drag the whole thing into a playlist, delete the song that you don't want, and pretend it never existed. It's an unusual guest spot because, I mean, young people probably don't care about U2, and U2's entrenched fans potentially don't really care about Kendrick Lamar. It maybe seems like a status thing, just saying, like, I can get one of the biggest bands in the world on my record. Doesn't really matter if it's any good or not, but look, they're here.
Also, we should note, just from a success point of view, Humble full stop is his Kendrick Lamar's biggest solo chart hit by a long, long way. Only his guest verse on Bad Blood by Taylor Swift got any higher in the charts, and that got to number 4. And just to reiterate the points we were discussing after Sophia's email, it doesn't seem to have harmed his critical reputation or his career in any way at all that this is his first solo, you know, smash.
Mm-hmm. So at number 5 is Drake with Passion Fruit, which I think I like very much. Do you actually like it?
Yeah, I really like it. Yeah, I do.
Okay. Well done, Drake. At number 4, sadly, he is not risen. He is sunken. Harry Styles, A Sign of the Times, is this week's number 4. Now, he's been on a bit of a publicity tour. He was on Graham Norton this week, and I watched that performance, and that particular rendition of it really hammered home the classic Robbie ballad meets Bowie-ness of this song. I kind of, you know, as much as people want to be like, I think people have a lot of good faith in this Harry Styles album, and I would count myself among that. You know, people have been reading a lot of very classy signifiers and like influence into what he's doing. And I'm sure he is perfectly influenced by people like David Bowie. But I like also that it's really not shy of tipping its hat to somebody like Robbie Williams, whether that's intentional or not. Like one of the biggest breakout boy band stars of all time. It's somebody who knows his cultural history, and he strikes me as, I mean, obviously he was in one of the biggest boy bands in the world. He seems like somebody who is neither afraid of highbrow nor lowbrow. And I really like the way that this song does both of those things and could be M.O.R., but is not M.O.R. I think that's a careful balance.
It's a really difficult one, and it can be really easily tipped up, as I discovered on Sunday last week, where we were talking about the SNL performance that he did, both of Sign of the Times and of that the other new song that he's got.
Ever Since New York.
That's right. And I'd watched Sign of the Times, and I was really disappointed with it. I thought that it wasn't mixed particularly well. He didn't sing it particularly well. And my favourite bits in the song weren't represented. He didn't really sing. You know, he does that thing where you duck under the high notes because obviously your voice was only able to get those high notes once, and that was in the studio. Just after I'd seen that, the journalist Mark Savage, who works for the BBC, said that his wife had watched the SNL performance, and then she'd just gone, well, this is just the Stereophonics. Why is everyone getting so excited?
Oh, no.
So I had this real moment of like, actually, you're right. Oh, dear. And like the part of me that is like fights against my own innate music snobbery is like, yeah, well, so what if it's a Stereophonics? It's like a good Stereophonics, so that's okay. But I was still a bit like, no, but all the stuff that I could hear before has gone now. And all I can hear is the sludge and the sort of the workmanlike quality. Whereas before I'd heard all this ethereal elfin despair and this the open heart of his singing and all of that stuff. And I went back to the recording, and obviously it's all still there. It's all fine. But it wasn't until the Graham Norton performance, which I do urge everybody who's interested in Harry Styles to check out, because I think that is immaculate pop TV, to the point where it rooted me to my seat when I watched it. And I just had the telly on. It wasn't even like I went to see a clip on YouTube. I had the telly on. He said, now Harry Styles. And the way that they presented it was glorious. The way that he sang it was beautiful. He did all the bits that I like in just the way that I like them. And I was floored by it, absolutely floored by it. It just reminded me of what an astonishing song it is to be released now to aim for the charts in 2017.
Well, so I think last week we were talking about how we thought this song was, well, about the apocalypse, and it does seem to be about the apocalypse, but this week a big Harry Styles profile came out in Rolling Stone magazine where he talks about the song in terms I don't think anybody had imagined it existed.
No, it's supposedly about the song is written from the perspective of a mother who is about to give birth to a child but has been told by a doctor that there's a complication and that she's not going to make it. So she's trying to impart some kind of life wisdom to her as yet unborn child about, but then why are we always stuck and running from the bullets does make absolutely no sense in that context as a line. It's not even metaphorically good. It's crazy. So I think there is definitely a case to be argued where you say, I don't care what you think your song is about. Emotionally, it's about this to me. And I, you know, so I'm seeing, you know, it's called Sign of the Times. I'm seeing terrified people looking to the future, looking, especially in the context of world politics, and being really, really worried about where everything is going, but trying to pull their families together. So there is the family side of it. All that warmth is still there. But absolutely nobody went, do you know what? I can really tell this is about a mum, you know, a pregnant woman terrified of her own death, talking to her unborn child about how she wouldn't be around even after they were born. It's not in anything.
But I do really like that as an origin story, actually. It's like, I mean, I'm putting words into Harry Styles' own mouth here, but I do think that point that you made about, like, you know, as a music critic, just put on my wanky hat, I think that interpretation is just as valid as intention.
Yeah.
On the artist's part. And I like the idea that although you can't necessarily hear the whole like mother-child dialogue in the song, I like how it works as an origin point for the song, and it very much seems like somebody who's come out of a boy band and is a bit concerned about being thought of as vapid and just thinking like, okay, what's the biggest, most serious thing I can think of? A mum having a baby, but she's going to die and she's got to give it this really important message. There's something kind of very grandiose and innocent about it at the same time. And I love the song that he got out of it. So I am all for the flowery origin story.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, very much so. And while we're on, you know, looking at your position in the world based on, and gender politics to an extent, There's a fantastic quote in the Rolling Stone interview that we just mentioned, which we, I mean, we, do we want to flag up the fact that Rolling Stone got Cameron Crowe to do the interview? Cameron Crowe, upon whom the film Almost Famous is based?
Yeah, I mean, it's I think Cameron Crowe is a good writer. You know, there are some doodly writing tropes in this piece, but it's very, like, it's all about image. It's saying, like, we have got the classic rock journalist who hardly ever writes about anybody to come and do the Harry Styles profile. I mean, I have interviewed Cameron Crowe, and he's a very nice man. I don't really know him, but I was almost surprised that he would go for something as nakedly positioning as saying, we want you specifically and all of the connotations that you bring to be brought to bear on this profile and this artist. I did enjoy it. You know, as a piece of, like, you know, pop journalism pantomime, it was brilliant.
It's, yes. And what was interesting as well is that Harry, just to bring it back to my original point, Harry makes a quote about young girls and pop music, which is lovely. It's just a lovely, simple thing to have said, and that received what can only be described as a Twitter round of applause, where he said, essentially, who's to say the young girls who like pop music, which is short for popular, have worse musical taste than a 30-year-old hipster guy? That's not up to you to say. Music is something that's always changing. There's no goalposts. Young girls like the Beatles. You're going to tell me that they're not serious? How can you say young girls don't get it? They're our future doctors, lawyers, mothers, presidents. They kind of keep the world going. And teenage girl fans, they don't lie. If they like you, they're there. They don't act too cool. They like you, and they tell you, which is sick. You have to say it like that. It's in italics, that bit. But I think that's an underlining point about all pop music, that it's whilst boys have been traditionally the ones that have made it, it's girls that make it happen. They're the fuel of the whole thing, the teenage girl thing. And they're the least credited in the whole history of popular music for making pop music happen, and they absolutely did. If there were no girls screaming at Elvis, there would be no Elvis, and that's the fuel that fuels the rocket that is pop music. So it's just nice to have pop stars acknowledge it from time to time.
Totally. I can kind of see it from two sides. The American critic Hazel Sills tweeted that she didn't think it was really that radical for him to acknowledge his fans because they pay his bills, and of course he should be doing that. And I do understand that, but also I think that it's so rare that anybody in his position has ever come out and acknowledged that contract, and that these people deserve respect because they are there and because their enthusiasm is unfettered. I think that is the rare part of it. And I was also very heartened by the fact that he came out and said it.
It goes so far beyond "thank you to my fans, I love you all," the way that Justin Bieber does, and it says, "You guys are getting..."
The way that Liam Payne used to do.
Yeah, well, quite. And it's saying, "I know you guys get a rough time for what you consider to be your taste from people with a snooty attitude about it, and you and yet you are." And in the broader historical context, yes, they made everything happen, but also him speaking directly to 1D fans is saying, don't let anybody tell you that what you like isn't your own opinion isn't valid. And yeah, it's a bloke saying that to girls. Yeah, it's a privileged person saying it to an unknown quantity of people, but it isn't said enough.
Agreed. At number three is Ed Sheeran with Galway Girl, which I don't know if anybody else has seen this, but there was a news report from the video shoot this week, which stars the Irish actress Saoirse Ronan, in which apparently she gives him a tattoo, or I think she handwrites a tattoo, which he then gets tattooed on in the video. But instead of writing Galway Girl, she purposefully wrote Galway Grill. I don't really know much about Saoirse Ronan, but I would just like to reaffirm the idea that not all heroes wear capes.
I'm sure she'd look very fetching in a cape.
I did try to do it at karaoke last night, but unfortunately the karaoke system had not yet updated to include Galway Girl. I thought,
give it time.
I should put this repeat exposure to good use. Number two is Clean Bandit featuring Zara Larsson with Symphony, which is up three places.
And it's definitely proof of what we were talking about actually before with the email from Sophia. Clean Bandit are a quite faceless group, and they bring in different singers each time, and none of the singers that they've worked with the possible exception of Jess Glynn, have sort of facial star quality, if you want. They don't have the possibility of them becoming Taylor Swift style icons, and yet Clean Bandit are consistently having hit singles and iconic music in a way. So it doesn't really matter whether you personally have charisma or the X Factor or whatever, so long as you're coming up with the musical goods.
At number one, back on the top spot, Ed Sheeran is number one with Shape of You, which doesn't feel like a massive surprise, really, does it?
No, this is one of those Song of the Year songs. We've said it before, and the Harry Styles song feels like it's peculiar to one particular emotion. It's very, very powerful in that emotion, but Shape of You is for weddings and for first dances and for discos and for all sorts. What do young people call going out and dancing these days? When they do that, then
the club.
The club, that's it.
But the club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where they go. So usually this is a point where we would look at the week's new releases, but because we're in slightly compromised circumstances, we are going to return to the new releases next week and chat about things such as Paramore and some unusual lyrics in a Charlie Puth single then. So we're going to leap straight on to our most streamed songs this week. Fraser, what's yours?
I really like the Lana Del Rey and The Weeknd song, Lust for Life. I've never heard a song called Lust for Life that sounds less like it's been made by people who are alive. But that's part of Lana Del Rey's charm, isn't it? I mean, she's dead, isn't she? She's actually a ghost. She's a ghost person making pop music. And that's what makes lyrics like take off, take off, take off all your clothes, which is the kind of hook line of the song, even more bizarre because, you know, Lana's singing
it's like
about...
prepare for an embalming rather than a sexy moment.
It does sound exactly like that. It sounds like an elegy for lost youth. And it's a song that is seemingly comprised of the last thoughts of a 50s teenager who died on Dead Man's Curve. And the weird thing is, even having The Weeknd come in and be sort of audibly slightly more alive doesn't rectify the situation at all. You can treat all of this as being some kind of metaphor for entrancement, because I do think it's a lovely song. I really like Lana Del Rey. I like the fact that she's in pop music making this ethereal thing without coming across like Enya, but it's just hilarious that this is every single song she does that talks about sex. There's quite a lot of Lana Del Rey songs are about sex, and you're just like, you don't have sex, you're a ghost, you're a corporeal entity, you can't have the pneumatic reality of sex. It's just not something that is physically possible. Now play that song again while I cry.
Let's listen to a bit now. My most streamed song this week, I have not really, but despite being at a pop music conference, I haven't really listened to any music. My iPod has remained resolutely in my bag, other than to listen to William Basinski's Disintegration Loops on the Plane, which I highly recommend if you ever need to fall asleep on an aircraft. So I will say my most streamed song this week is Waterloo by ABBA, it's currently 10 a.m. where I am as I record this, and I was singing it at 1:45 this morning and having a riotous time. So yeah, ABBA. And in many ways, that was also our Waterloo, because that is the end of this week's On Break My Chart.
Thanks for listening and subscribing. You can email your thoughts on the charts or reviews of any part, particular chart-bothering songs or artists, to unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. Let us know what's going on in your charts or send any other pop-related inquiries our way.
And I'm really sorry for the fact last week there was no Spotify playlist, but we will make one this week and it will be in the show notes where you can subscribe to it and listen.
You can find us both on Twitter. I'm at @CSI_popmusic.
I am at Laura Snapes.
Our producer is away this week, but he is the great Tame Mawson. So if there's any audible fluffs or anything that's gone horribly wrong, that's all my fault. But we'd love it if you could leave us a review on iTunes, or tell your friends, or make a big poster about Unbreak My Chart and stick it in the window of your living room. See you next week.
Bye.